it's my brother and I's love letter to an era, basically. We just want to be part of that era. That's like our dream. You know, we haven't built a time machine, not yet. But when we do, that's where we're going.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of The Apex. I'm your host, Archie, and today I'm joined by Nikita Bryden. Nikita is a car designer and co-founder of Oilstain Lab, a boutique automotive design consultancy operating out in California. Nikita runs the company with his brother, Ilya, and they are perhaps best known for their most recent creation, the Half 11. The Half 11 is essentially half a 911, half kind of custom race car. It is road legal. It's very difficult to explain what it is, but I think that's what makes it so cool and unique. And I'm hoping Nikita is going to be able to tell us a little bit more. Nikita, welcome to the show.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited. It's cool.
No worries, man. My pleasure. I mean, I remember seeing the Half 11 on my Instagram and just thinking that's like the wildest thing I've ever seen.
Yeah. I mean, that was kind of the brief, you know. We had a 911 tub and, you know, we spent about a year thinking what we could do with it. And we built a few 911s before, and it's obviously a crowded field, right? You have amazing stuff in the Porsche community, Singer, Gunther Works, Tudhill, so many different takes. And ours is probably the most maybe unhinged one.
I think that it definitely is. There's no doubt about that. But before we get into the Half 11, obviously, you know, now you're an accomplished car designer, but I kind of want to go back a bit to your early years. You know, were you surrounded by cars from a young age?
Yes and no. So my brother and I, we grew up in rural Canada. There was no car community there. I remember getting excited when I'd see an Audi. You know, that's like, that's the level of cars that we were exposed to as kids. But we did travel a lot, and we went to Europe, and we were in Spain one year, and we saw a Diablo, and the guy in the dealership let us like sit in it. And then that's it. That became like the dream car. And I don't know, we were just drawing cars from then on. And yeah, it was like a single path from like, I don't know, 6 or 7 years old. So
that was kind of the dream then, to become a car designer from a young age.
Yeah, I mean, we pretty much were hell-bent on that. Then we went, my grandparents lived in England, so we went to another key moment was seeing that McLaren F1 in London in that little store. And that was just like, I have a very unhappy photo of us standing there next to the car, but it was a very pivotal moment. And yeah, I think that car probably inspired so many other designers or motorsports or gearheads. But after that, it was like, okay, that's it. We want to be part of this. We want to be car designers. And at 13, we basically dropped out of high school, and at 14, moved to Italy to study car design. So yeah, high school dropout.
That's insane. I mean, dropping out of high school to go and study car design in Italy is probably one of the coolest things I've ever heard. And it does sound like the actions of someone who is dead set on becoming a car designer. But that's a huge decision. Were your family quite supportive of that?
I think the parents, I mean, they both have PhDs. They're both incredibly smart and accomplished. I think they thought it was a phase that we would grow out of. You know, we did get good grades. We were good students. It just had no interest in math or being a lawyer or being a doctor. And so, yeah, they eventually gave in and supported it. But I still do believe they thought it would be a phase, that we would grow out of it, that we'd stop drawing pictures of cars and, you know, choose a real career. But they did support us.
And so could you maybe talk me through a little bit about what it was like actually studying car design over in Italy? What is it like?
Oh, well, I mean, it's looking back at it now, it's vastly different than, like, you know, afterwards we went and we studied in California as well. And work professionally. But in Italy, I mean, for us, it was the dream, right? Pininfarina, Giugiaro, Bertone, Gandini, like the icons of design. And we were young, we were sponges, right? So we picked everything up. The Italian approach, I remember we had an ergonomics class. And, you know, you would think ergonomics is about making the human comfortable inside the car. And in Italy, in that class, they were just like, no. Your car's ugly. Like, the side view's ugly. Let's recline the human back. Let's slide them. Like, they were just doing these weird things with the human driving position just to get like a beautiful exterior. And in a way, I think that sums up a lot of the reasons of why like Italian car design is so, I mean, it's so like aspirational. It's so romantic. It's this beautiful idea. And yes, there's some compromises, but like when you're in the car looks so good. Like who cares, right? So yeah. I don't know. It's a very distinctly different approach than say more of a German approach or a Japanese approach, or, you know, in California, for example, the school just emphasized art and visuals and creating the most beautiful sunset renderings, you know, because we are blessed with, you know, amazing weather here. And so the artistic value was very important here in California, less so in Italy. So there's these profound differences of, you know, skill sets and what they emphasize.
And if you had to boil it down, what would you say is like your key takeaway from studying car design in Italy that you've then applied later on in your career as a designer?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny looking back at it, but I mean, it really set the basis for what Oil Stain Lab became. You know, in Italy, it was basically coach building, the romanticism, the idea of what a car could be. And then California informed us a little bit more with sort of storytelling, you know, the whole Hollywood connection, and obviously the technical skills, the digital skills that we later learned, and that became Oil Stain Lab. So it's yeah, we're basically two ingredients, you know.
Yeah, fused together. No, definitely.
Exactly.
And I believe you didn't go and start Oil Stain Lab straight after your studies. I believe you went and worked for some big brands like Honda. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. So, after moving from Italy, studied whatever here in Pasadena, and then our first job, for those that don't know, I'm a twin. Ilya Bryden is my brother, and we studied together. We did the whole Italy adventure and then California. And then after we graduated, we actually got a job offer to go together to Toyota. So we spent a year at Toyota, developing some stuff for them. Then Honda poached us. So we both together went to Honda, and then he stayed there for 6 years. He did a bunch of production cars. I think at this point they've built, I don't know, 6.5 million of his designs or whatever on the road. CR-V, RDX, and then a bunch of the new cars that are coming out. And, me personally, after Honda, I went to Hyundai Genesis. That was just when Genesis was becoming a brand. So it was part of those strategy meetings. And then General Motors Advanced, which was basically Chevrolet, Buick, Cadillac, you know, all the American cars that you guys don't get over there. Then we worked for a few other companies. There was a Chinese company that was we worked for, GAC. But yeah, so been all over the place. It's been a decade in the OEM industry, which is, yeah, we've learned a lot, I would say. That's vital.
I was going to say, I mean, what would you say is sort of like the best thing about working at those big companies, and what's the worst thing about working for those kinds of companies from a design point of view?
So the best thing is the amount of just sheer talent and skill set and experience that these companies have had, right? They've been building cars for 100 years. They know how to do it. And the people they hire are so goddamn talented. So you're constantly learning. You're constantly being pushed, challenged. And just because the cars are ugly, like, no, it's not the designer's fault. Trust me, it's not. There's so many cool cars that are like in the studio that are designed, and then, you know, management will just kill it. They'll just pick the ugliest one. So yes, there's so many talented people, so many cool processes that you learn. And you know, that's vital. The worst part is the speed that things move at, number one. And kind of connected to that is projects get canceled all the time. You know, I worked on a project for 3 years, and at the end, they're just like, all right, crumple up the paper, throw it in the trash bin. That's dead. You know, so you dedicate 3 years of your life, passion, you know, creativity, sleepless nights when you go home and you're like, oh, I don't know how to solve this. And then they're just like, all right, just take it all back and shoot it. You know, it's tough.
That's interesting. There's a few things that I want to unpack there. first thing you said sort of about modern car design being a bit ugly, I was actually watching a video of Ken Okuyama, former head of design at Pininfarina, and he was on Jay Leno, and he was talking about the Code 57 that he designed. And he said that in modern car design was getting so complicated, and that's somewhat attributable to branding. You know, these companies want you to look at the car and know exactly which company it belongs to. Do you sort of agree with that? And what are your thoughts on sort of modern car design more generally?
I will agree with that to a degree. Part of what I was doing a lot was basically brand strategy, and I was probably part of four rebrandings for four different brands where the only thing they cared about was basically headlight DRL shape and grille shape. And it's like, you know, let's come up with a grill shape that no one else has. And that's how you end up with like a Lexus spindle or, you know, like weird shapes. So yes, there definitely is an element to like very branded. You have to stand out. You know, part of it is just the way we consume information. We consume images these days. We're very overwhelmed, right, on social media, on the internet, everything. And it becomes, yeah, it becomes difficult. I think also it speaks to like a lack of confidence from brands. You know, like Porsche is not really chasing something new. They're just confident in what they do. And if a brand is unconfident, then they're like, yeah, let's create this weird shape that no one else has done because we'll stand out. It's like, it's not the solution. and there was the ugly part of modern cars. I mean, honestly, a lot of it is just legislation. There's a lot that goes into crash in terms of like clearances and volumes. And that's why the cars are just getting bigger and bigger and more bloated. And you can't really have too many sharp edges. And granted, Cybertruck just doesn't care. But yeah, it's a very difficult environment. And everything's like designed by committee. Let's not offend anybody. Let's, you know, let's ask the, you know, 65-year-old white guy what he thinks, you know, and it's just, it's not what it used to be in the 70s. I'll say that.
Yeah, no, I get what you're saying completely. And I guess it's sort of the, you know, kind of boils down to, I guess you can call it bureaucracy. Is that part of the reason why you then went and set up Oil Stain Lab so that you could choose your own projects and have complete freedom from a design point of view?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we were doing quite a few freelance projects. You know, people were approaching us to do stuff. So there was a need to create that. And that part of Oil Stain Lab, no one's really seen or kind of that we can't take any credit for that. That's all behind NDAs. So we needed to create something that people would see us doing. And that was basically the sort of the genesis, let's say, of Half 11 to create a business card.
And so could you maybe touch on the sort of evolution of Oil Stain? Because I know you've done a few projects now. I've seen the dropped alpha that you've done and sort of the retro 911 and obviously the Half 11. Where did it all kind of start and what's the sort of evolution been like?
So Oil Stain Lab as an idea started back in 2013, actually. We started the company then only to realize basically like what we were doing was illegal because we weren't US citizens and we weren't allowed to start our own company. So we shut it down like 3 weeks later. Like, oh, we're so sorry. And it basically laid dormant until 2019. But the idea was always at its core, Oil Stain Lab was a like a creative hub, an enabler, if you will. And so that's why it's not like Brighton Design Studio. It's not our last name. It was really supposed to be a much bigger thing. And there were a few people involved at the start and it was kind of an art collective, let's say. And then it slowly evolved into just my brother and I, because we're stubborn. We're like, this thing's not going to fail. Like, we're just going to keep going. And so we kept doing Oil Stain Lab, but it was very much a design consultancy at that point. So it was not even the old cars or anything. It was, you know, we were working on things like headphones or like coffee and like whatever was kind of linked to automotive, but got us outside of the corporate world. If it was interesting, we would do it. If it was boring, we wouldn't do it. And then, yeah, basically it became the vintage builds that you're talking about. So like dropped alpha. We built a GTD6, safari car for Ether. Obviously the Huna Pegasus, the Ken Block one. And so, yeah, it became that. And I think that was tied also to the half 11 sort of progression. And then in the future, Oil Stain Lab shifting to be more of a boutique builder, let's say. So, yeah, there's a new car that'll come out probably this year that'll probably shift everyone's expectations of what we are again. But yeah, it's fun to pivot, fun to explore what's possible.
Yeah, no, that's super cryptic and it sounds exciting. It's almost like your playground, it feels like, when you're sort of describing it. You can kind of just pick and choose whatever resonates with you as designers. But I guess on the Half 11 in particular, did that have a kind of origin story? Like, why did you want to go and create that car? Because, you know, it's gone pretty viral on social media. You're obviously already on the map, but it's definitely gotten you a lot of attention, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think there were a lot of interesting things happening. You have to go back to like 2018, 2019 when that project was starting. For us, the whole point of the Half 11 was to tell, you know, yeah, it was a business card for the design studio, but really we wanted to tell a story. You know, we're obsessed with stories. And when we looked at the car space, they're just the only car stories that were happening either on TV or social media. It's like, oh, there's a show coming up. We need to finish this car in like a week. And like, you know, there's that fake pressure or, you know, they all fell into these categories. And so we wanted to tell a story that would resonate with not just car people, right? So we wanted it to resonate with, you know, people that are fans of history, people that are fans of science fiction, of fantasy, and sort of create a little tribe that way. There was also the whole disinformation thing starting with like the Donald Trump elections and like all that stuff way back when, you know, and so that was top of mind. What's real, what's not real. And so, yeah, we were playing with all these things and how do we sort of intertwine all that? So it became like a, I don't know, visual diary, like a little concept of how to tell a story. And then obviously this car came out of it. It took us a year probably to decide. And then my brother Ilya created a sketch and it was the Interscope IndyCars attached, like the back half of an Interscope IndyCar and the front half of a 911. And this sketch became, we're just like, okay, we got to do that. Like, that's it. Let's go chase that. And, you know, obviously it's evolved so much since that. We've shared basically the entire process with the internet, which is, again, very different from what we do in car design. Normally everything's secret. You go to a car show, you unveil a car, everyone claps, you know, and there's no like behind the scenes. So we wanted to lift that veil a bit and show people how a car gets developed, you know, and part of it was also to learn on our behalf, because when we started the project, like we didn't know how to weld, didn't know how to metal shape, didn't know how to do much of anything. And so a lot of people, you know, you could call them haters, but they were basically like, oh, this is shit. Like, oh, that's terrible. And we're like, oh, okay, we should probably get better, you know? So it was an education by fire, I would say.
That's really interesting, actually. On the sort of storytelling aspect, it kind of ties directly into the whole Photoshop backstory that you did with this car. And when I first saw it, I was like, oh, maybe it's kind of like a sort of satirical thing, bit of a wind up. But actually, I think it really does play into that storytelling. It's like, you know, what if this was actually the case? These cars existed. And did that help you as designers sort of build the context around this car, if that makes any sense?
Yeah, no, you're exactly hitting on it. So, you know, that the historic things always come up because it's like, oh, are you like trying to make people look dumb or something? Like, no, I wasn't really. The intent was never to be like to make people look foolish or anything. Really what it was is as designers, we're always looking 10 or 15 years in the future, right? And we have to imagine technologies. We have to imagine that world. And with this project, we had to create a world that limited the scope of what we could do. And part of that was creating these images, seeing the car in the context of the other race cars, the fashion, the architecture, the graphic design of the sponsors, and being like, okay, does it fit in? Does it not? So it was like, it was a little bit of a visual check for us. It was a little bit playing with the whole disinformation thing. What's real, what's not, shocking people out of the blasé sort of condition, right? You're just scrolling on Instagram and what forces you to stop is something that's like wait, is that real? Is that not real? And of course, humor. Like, there's definitely, you know, some of the Photoshops we did were definitely like supposed to be funny. And, you know, they're not trying to trick you. It's like, it's a joke. It's like, have some fun, you know, because all car design is just so damn serious.
They made me smile. But I guess on the design specifically of the Half 11, when I was looking at it, I was kind of reminded of the design adage, a design is done when there's nothing left to take away. And I don't think there is really anything you can take away from the Half 11. You know, it doesn't even have like a windscreen. Was that something that you had front of mind when you were designing it? Or is that a bit too much of a textbook approach? It wasn't really what you were thinking.
I mean, yeah, again, you're hitting on exactly what we were, you know, kind of conceptually trying to achieve. I think in modern car design, everybody adds things to be different, right? And we really wanted to subtract things because, again, we were bored at our day jobs, let's say. You know, it's like the same approach. It's formulaic. So the idea was to, subtract things. Like, how minimal can you make things? What can we get rid of? You know, obviously, it started with, basically half a body. And then we decided, okay, that looks cool, but it looks really crude and home-built. Like, you know, it was more along the lines of like the Berg Spider, the hill climb Porsche car. But then it sort of evolved. Okay, let's put some rear fenders on it, you know. Then now actually it's a coupe, which we did for our cross country trip because we couldn't imagine driving 3,200 miles in that thing with no roof and no windscreen. So, so it's slowly evolved. The ethos was always, I mean, the other thing is like, basically, we had no real skills to like make complicated stuff, and to make things takes time. And this was a weekend project. And so there's like a number of other reasons that are less glamorous of why minimalism was a good approach, let's say.
And you touched on it there. I mean, I think you drove from California to New York for the Montauk Rally. What was it like to drive?
Yeah, I mean, that trip is like super, super special for all of us. I mean, it's the king of sort of bad ideas. Up to that point, the longest drive that car had completed was 80 miles. So it was a little bit of a hope and a prayer. And we got together like a really good film crew. So we got like a 9-minute video that'll come out soon about that. But I mean, the car, it's pretty comfortable inside. I think it's more comfortable than our we have like a 73 RSR Tribute, straight piped. The Half 11 is much louder inside than the straight piped RSR, but the seating position and everything in the Half 11, I mean, it's designed around me, so of course it's comfortable for me. but if you're taller than 5'7", it's trouble. It was a little bit toasty, What else? No, I mean, honestly, it was good. It was very comfortable. It's not like super stiff or anything. It's a comfortable car. It's just gets a lot of attention. You know, every single car that passes you has got their phone out. So it's a little dangerous. You're just like, are you paying attention? Are you going to hit me? But yeah, it was good.
I guess get a little bit nerdy. What are the actual components of the car? Like, what engine have you put in it?
So this is effectively like, the prototype. So the most controversial part is the engine. We've got a custom built LSV8 in it. It's got a crazy big bore, really short stroke. So it revs out to 8,500 RPM, about 650 horsepower on pump gas. The transmission is a 996 GT2 box. Porsche that's been flipped upside down for the mid-engine application. The front suspension and everything is because we retain the 911 tub. So the steering front suspension is all basically really high-end and heavily customized RSR Porsche stuff. And then the whole rear suspension that was designed by Joe Scarbo here in California. All the inboard suspension, everything. And structures were designed by professional engineer, so it is somewhat safe.
It's interesting that you mentioned the gearbox was out of the 996 GT2. That's actually one of my favorite Porsches. I don't know if you've ever seen the like the mischief movies from the early 2000s, like Rob Lonman on the Gumball Rally, like putting that car.
Yeah. Nice.
And so I guess, is there a commercial element to this? Can people buy the Half 11?
Yeah. So it's been a great surprise to us to see it being advertised on different websites. No, you technically you cannot buy a Half 11. We've had quite a few people reach out. This was never a commercial product. I mean, it basically has no doors. It's hot. It's cramped. It's my brother and I's love letter to an era, basically. We just want to be part of that era. That's like our dream. You know, we haven't built a time machine, not yet. But when we do, that's where we're going. We're in a spa in 1972. But we are working on something that is basically commercial. That's the next car, loosely based on that, but a very different approach. The approach is much more what we do as our day job. So it's a professional designed, engineered car. It's much different, but similar.
And will the Half 11 be making any sort of public appearances? I heard rumors that it might be running at Fat Aspen. Is that true?
Yeah, no, we're getting ready for a new livery. We've got a ski rack for it. It's definitely looking like we're going to be there. And then we're pushing to try and do a Goodwood run this year with it. So we'll see.
That would be epic. I'd love to see that go up the hill. That would be so cool. I almost prefer the fact that the Half 11 is like you can't just buy it. It is literally you and your brother's vision and love letter, like you said, and you don't see much of that. And so I think that's really cool, and I take my hat off to you. And so, I mean, you touched on it a little bit, but what is next for Oil Stain Lab? Can you tell us anything more about the next project?
Yeah, so I mean the next car, we're basically going through a lot of the final sort of production engineering on it right now. It like I said, it's very loosely based on what that car is. It's just much more modern. The Porsche purists will be thrilled. It'll have flat six power, so don't fret. it's no longer 911 based. It's a bespoke car, fully bespoke chassis. We've started with a blank sheet. There's nothing carryover. Completely new, and it's just it's our vision of what is missing in today's world of cars, high performance cars. You know, we don't call it a supercar, we don't call it a hypercar. It's just what's missing in modern day cars, and a lot of it is just bloat and weight. So yeah, it's a very compact car. It's very lightweight. It's pretty extreme. So yeah, that's all I can share.
That sounds amazing. I really do look forward to seeing it. So but best of luck with that. I think to end on, I was actually going to ask you a few quick fire questions. I'm curious to know what is, in your opinion, the most beautiful car ever made.
Whoa, impossible question. That's impossible. I think, you know, there's so many ways to like evaluate beauty. You know, whether it's form and function, whether it's just pure styling. I mean, I think it's hard to argue with the beauty of like a Ferrari 250 in any of those really variations, right? Or a Jaguar E-Type, just from pure styling. You know, for me, I generally gravitate towards the beautiful GTs. Having said that, you know, I have such respect for like what Gandini did, and one of my one favorite car is like the Countach, the very early one, you know, like a Periscopo. But I would argue it's not necessarily a beautiful car, but it's shocking, it's interesting, it's challenging. And then of course you've got the race cars, you know. I'm sort of losing my love for the 330 P4 slowly, you know. So I can't go there anymore. I'm starting to question my choices. That's probably what I would have said like 5 years ago, but it's eroding. But yeah, I mean, I don't think there's too many cars past 1975 that I would call genuinely beautiful, because at that stage, I think it gets commercial, it gets like mass produced, there's limitations. And, you know, as my eyes become like more sensitive over like the last 15 years of being a car designer, you start to see things, start get educated on why things look the way they are. And you're like, I can't respect that anymore. It's ugly now, you know, it's a curse.
So my answer to that question, and I know it's incredibly subjective, you're right, but mine is the Alpha 33 Stradale, you know, Franco Scaglione. I was wondering, like, you know, what are your thoughts on that? Like, do they have like a shrine to him in Italy?
Yeah, so 33 Stradale was definitely, it's up there, yeah. And a similar car is what, the Tomasina? It's another beautiful car, similar shape to that. But yeah, 33 Stradale is cool. I think it has one or two awkward angles, and then they're all different, right? So it's like, which chassis do you like? Because the vents are different, the little radiuses are different. But yeah, 33 Stradale, you can't argue with that. I'm not a fan of the new car that Alfa came out with. But the vintage one, yeah, I've been fortunate to see it, I don't know, a dozen times now. Love it. Absolutely love it. So great choice.
I'm glad you approve. Who's your favorite designer?
Oh man, I impossible, but I think I just have to go with Gandini. I just love the wedges. I just love what that did and how it shocked people and the purity and the simplicity of all the early stuff. So that's what I'm going to go with. And then otherwise, you know, I love the sort of the Figoni and Filaschi coach built cars. Very voluptuous. They're insane. Probably butchered the pronunciation of that. But yeah, love those cars. Just they're so different, so exaggerated. But that was a coach building house. So
I might be about to embarrass myself here, but did Gandini do the Stratos?
I think he did. Yeah. Yeah.
That's like my second most beautiful car.
That was a Bertone. So yeah, I'm sure that was Gandini.
And final question, what is in your dream three car garage?
Oof, well, I'm gonna have to plug myself here, the next car. No, I mean, gosh, you'd have to have a race car, proper race car. So I'd want a vintage F1 car. We have a vintage F2 car. It's because that's all I can afford, but the dream is a vintage F1 car, probably like 69 to 71 in that era. Ooh, or a Brabham BT44. That would be cool. That would be very cool. Then I'd need a wedge car. So I think it would have to be a choice between basically the Modulo, the Pininfarina Modulo, Lancia Stratos Zero, or just an early Countach Periscopo. And then what else? I'd be missing probably third one. That's the hardest. That's the hardest to choose. Probably just a 70s Le Mans racer. Yeah. Maybe a Ferrari 312. Or they did a really cool hill climb car. Maybe I'd get the Ferrari hill climb car. It was terrible. It got destroyed by Porsche, but gosh, it was so cool. So those would be the three.
You have impeccable taste, Nikita, but that should come as no surprise. It's been fantastic to have you on, Nikita. I'm conscious of your time, but thank you so much for coming on, and I really do take my hat off to you and everything you're doing at Oil Stain, and I wish you the very best of luck with it all.
Appreciate it, man. It's been fun. Yeah, thank you for the fun questions.